This podcast may contain explicit language.
Welcome to the Greatest Movie of All Time podcast, the show that uses a unique grading style to redefine what the greatest movies are. I'm Tom Duncan.
And I'm Dana Duncan.
Tonight, for our 207th episode, and for only the second time in the history of the show, we are settling a score and a tie between a couple of films on our Master Greatest Movies of All Time list, with Goldfinger from 1964 and American Graffiti from 1973, currently tied for 53rd on our current list. Let's start here with American Graffiti. Cast is George Lucas as writer-director, William Huck as writer, Gloria Katz as a writer, Richard Dreyfuss as Kurt Henderson, Ron Howard as Steve Bolander, also credited as Ronnie Howard, which I just find funny, Paul LaMatte as John Milner, Charles Martin Smith as Terry Fields, credited as Charlie Martin Smith, Candy Clark as Debbie, Mackenzie Phillips as Carol, Cindy Williams as Lori, Wolfman Jack as the disc jockey, Bo Hopkins as Joe, and Harrison Ford as Bob Felfa. American Graffiti was released on August 11th, 1973. Upon release, the film received almost universal acclaim and on a budget of $777,000 would go on to make roughly $140 million, finishing number three at the box office for 1973. The film was nominated for Best Picture, Director for George Lucas, Supporting Actress for Clark, Original Screenplay, and Film Editing. The film has since been recognized by the American Film Institute three different times. For 1998's AFI's 100 Years, 100 Movies at number 77, 2000's 100 Years, 100 Laughs at number 43, and 2007's AFI's 100 Years, 100 Movies 10th Anniversary Edition at number 62. In 1995, American Graffiti was selected for preservation in the National Film Registry. Dad, do you have a plot summary for us for this one?
I do. American Graffiti is a nostalgic journey through the streets of Modesto, California in the early 1960s. Director George Lucas paints a vivid portrait of adolescence, capturing the essence of a generation on the brink of change. The film follows a group of friends on their last night together before they embark on separate paths. With a soundtrack filled with classic rock and roll hits, American Graffiti immerses viewers in the sights and sounds of the era, evoking a sense of longing for a simpler time. Through its relatable characters and heartfelt storytelling, the film resonates as a timeless ode to youth and the bittersweet passage of time.
Thank you. And for Goldfinger, our cast is Guy Hamilton as director, Richard Maybaum and Paul Den as writers, John Barry for music, Sean Connery as James Bond / 007, Honor Blackman as Pussy Galore, Gert Frobe as Auric Goldfinger, Shirley Eaton as Jill Masterson, Tanya Mallett as Tilly Masterson, Harold Sakata as Oddjob, Bernard Lee as M, Martin Benson as Mr. Solo, Chuck Linder as Felix Leiter, Austin Willis as Mr. Roy Simmons, and Lois Maxwell as Miss Moneypenny. Recognition for this one? Goldfinger was originally released on September 18, 1964. It received widespread critical acclaim at the time. On a budget of nearly $3 million, Goldfinger would go on to gross $120 million and finish as the number three box office finisher of 1964. At the 1965 Academy Awards, Norman Wanstall won the Academy Award for Best Sound Effects Editing, making Goldfinger the first Bond film to receive an Academy Award until Skyfall in 2013. The American Film Institute has honored the film four times. Number 90 for its best movie quote, a martini, shaken, not stirred. Number 53 for its best song, Goldfinger. Number 49 for best villain, Auric Goldfinger. And number 71 for most thrilling film. Dad, do you have our plot summary for this one?
I do. Goldfinger is a thrilling espionage film that follows James Bond on his mission to thwart the diabolical plans of the titular villain, Auric Goldfinger. Bond finds himself entangled in a high-stakes game of cat and mouse as he uncovers Goldfinger's scheme to contaminate the United States gold reserves at Fort Knox. With a blend of action-packed sequences, clever gadgets, and a charismatic performance by Sean Connery as Bond, Goldfinger delivers a captivating and entertaining spy adventure that keeps viewers on the edge of their seats from start to finish.
So as we do every week, Dad, let's start with, what is your relationship to these films?
Well, I know for a fact that I saw Goldfinger when it was on television, like a weekly movie type of thing on the network. And I think I don't know if I watched it the first time with my dad or if my dad told me it was on and I could watch it. I must have been about 7 or 8. Let's just say the naked woman covered in gold paint was rather titillating to a 7 or 8 year old boy.
So I believe there was a summer where I was staying with my grandparents, and I don't remember for what reason. I was just there by myself during the week, and we went over to the library and rented like 4 Bond films. And I think I've told this story before on the show, but it was Dr. No, it was Diamonds Are Forever, I think it was Goldfinger, and the other one was Live and Let Die. And for whatever reason, all 4 of those are like among my favorites yet to still watch. I think Live and Let Die might be easily my favorite Roger Moore because it's the least campy of any of them. Still has kind of the Connery aesthetic before they kind of moved into the more comedic Bond of the late 70s.
Yeah.
But this has always been up near the top of the list for me. I remember that when we covered this in season 1, it was in remembrance of Sean Connery when he had just recently passed away. And this has always been near the top of everybody's list of Bond movies. So the Bond franchise has been around for as far back as probably I was maybe 10. I think when this fascination with the Bond character and the Bond franchise started for me. I remember playing Bond trivia contests with my now departed friend, where we would go for literally 3 or 4 hours because neither of us could break the tie. It would come down to the most remote and ridiculous trivial questions in order to break it between the two of us. We'd have these marathon sessions of Bond trivia, and he'd probably get it on one of the Timothy Dalton movies or something else because he actually bothered to watch them, unlike me. I think I've seen each of them now 2 times, and that's more than enough as far as I'm concerned. That being said, American Graffiti was one I remember probably being talked about more than in my living memory. So I think the first time that I watched that one would be probably around 9, 10, 11 years old. I think I remember us renting it and watching it in the basement of the old house before we moved, and then never seeing it again until the pandemic, when it just happened to be on like Showtime or something. And it was when you had copious amounts of time to kill. So I'm like, hey, let's throw this on and then let's do it for the show. And so Sarah and I sat and watched it, and we did it for the show. And now I've probably seen it, I think this is 3 times since then.
For me, I do remember watching American Graffiti with my dad and my dad talking about it because he, of course, was just utterly fascinated with the cars.
That makes sense.
And he'd be pointing out, oh, there's a 1957, you know.
You mean your dad couldn't shut up in a movie either anytime he saw something that was interesting to him?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I know where this is going.
What do you mean going? It's already been there.
Yeah, okay.
Moving on.
Moving on what?
You were in the middle of your story.
Well, you interrupted me, so now I lost my train of thought. Can't you hear the caboose passing by the tracks? No, but I remember watching it with my dad and him going through, and of course, everything, you know, like it was commercial breaks. Every commercial break was some story about him as a teenager. Him and his uncles, because his uncles were actually, he has one uncle that's 3 years younger than him, and his 2 other uncles are like 1 year and 3 years older than him. So they all hung out together.
That makes sense. So what are these 2 movies actually about?
Well, American Graffiti is a come-of-age story or coming-of-age story. And it's really a precursor to the Vietnam War, which I find the ultimate thing, and I keep pointing this out, is when they give the synopsis of where everybody is now, and Richard Dreyfuss's character is a writer in Canada. That's a little wink that he was a draft dodger and fled, because that's how who ended up in Canada. And so, you know, we have one or Toad character is killed and is missing in action and not found. So it's in some way that's the innocence coming into on the edge of what would become the turmoil of the 60s, culminating in the riots at the Vietnam War era. For the Bond or for Goldfinger, it is pure action. It is a film about evil and combating evil, and it is an espionage film, and it is meant to be romantic and a little bit sexy and kind of a effort to make every man want to be James Bond, more or less, by making that whole lifestyle seem so fantastic. There's a reason why in this era, Bond was so closely tied to Hugh Hefner and Playboy, because it all gave that same aura of manliness, of extra testosterone and sex appeal, kind of what every man wanted to be.
I certainly agree that James Bond in its earliest format is a lot about wish fulfillment. It's a male fantasy of fast cars, fast women, and exotic locations. And there really isn't a whole lot of depth to these movies. They're very black and white in their characters. They're very two-dimensional. There's good guys, there's bad guys. There's very rarely in between. It's not until maybe you get to the Brosnan Bond, where GoldenEye kind of has this turncoat figure, that I think the series kind of changes. And eventually when we get to the Daniel Craig Bond, it takes on a completely new tone and aesthetic. But at least for the Connery Bonds, this is about the epitome of what you're going to get out of any one of these films. And that's why they're eminently rewatchable for most guys. As far as American Graffiti, again, I think I mentioned a lot of this last week when we did our top 1970s movies and it was on my list. But this is the early stages or preeminent teenage angst film. You could maybe point to a slightly earlier time in Rebel Without a Cause, but there's a significant gap between that movie and this movie as to people that are in high school, they're at a crossroads, they are about to embark on the rest of their lives, and they're trying to kind of just figure things out. And whether you want to talk Breakfast Club or Fast Times at Ridgemont High or Superbad or Dazed and Confused, any of these high school movies where they're told almost in a all-in-one-night type of situation or all-in-one-day type of format, I think that this is the precursor, the forerunner to all of those breakout movies later on. Even to the extent where we still have a lot of those types of movies now. There's something about youth and not knowing what's going to happen with your life that seems to resonate with everyone because everybody has to go through it.
Yeah, I agree for the most part. I think it's the precursor to a large genre of these type of films that didn't exist before. And as far as Bond, I mean, it started a series of television shows and on espionage and spies and secret organizations, the Mission Impossible, I Spy, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., all these TV shows and then later movies that were made all have their roots in James Bond. Both are iconic as far as creating a genre of film and television that I think exists. I think even some that are more loosely tied would not have made it, but for some of this, for example, Boy Meets World, I don't think is necessarily on television per se without American Graffiti to show the growth and depth of high school kids and the struggles they're meeting and trying and facing and trying to grow up?
Well, I think American Graffiti does beget John Hughes.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of John Hughes in Boy Meets World.
Anyway, that's just kind of where I am on this. And so, yeah, I think that both are very impactful films. And it's going to be interesting to see how we get through this and pick which one is the better one for each category.
All right. Now, before we move into the actual grading of things, I wonder, despite them being very vastly different films, different subjects, different aims, is there any way in which these are similar?
Oh, if you need
a second, that's okay. I mean, to be honest, I had some difficulty coming up with a few of them. I think they're dealing with the similar time period because Goldfinger is happening in the present, and that's 1964, and American Graffiti is flashing back to 1962. So you have some rough time overlap there. They're fairly male-driven movies, even though American Graffiti does have some, I would say, stronger female characters. It is not nearly as female-driven. We're following four male companions, friends, throughout the entirety of the movie, and we're interweaving into all four of their stories at seemingly any time. So I would say that those are the two that really stick out to me, per se, but like I said, these are very vastly different films.
I think both speak to a loss or a longing in society. One is a longing for more order, and the other is a longing for more freedom and challenging authority. And so I think these really are speak to two different generations. American Graffiti speaks to the baby boom, and Goldfinger speaks to those who fought in World War II and are now adults and starting their lives and families.
All right, before we get to the scoring, let's take our first commercial break and we will be right back. Before we jump back into the episode, next week for our 208th episode, we discuss a modern action classic with Man on Fire, celebrating its 20th anniversary, directed by Tony Scott, written by Brian Helgeland, music by Harry Gregson Williams, starring Denzel Washington, Dakota Fanning, Christopher Walken, and Giancarlo Giannini. You won't want to miss that one, so watch ahead of the show by searching the Real Good app to find where it's streaming for you. That's R-E-E-L. G-O-O-D. Dad, we're going to go a little out of order from what we normally do, and we're going to recognize our in memoriam here. Do we have anyone to remember this week?
Yes. Bruce Kessler, 88, American director. Did The Gay Deceivers, The Monkees, and McCloud. The Monkees were a TV show, and McCloud was Thursday mystery movie, along with Columbo and McMillan and Wife. He was also in racing.
Yeah, he actually drove the 24-hour Le Mans before he did any of his directorial work.
Impressive. Cole Brings Plenty, 27, American actor, was in the TV show 1923.
We also have Adrian Schiller, 60, British actor, was in The Last Kingdom, The New Look, and The Chelsea Detective. Finally, we have Jean-Paul Vignon, 89, French actor and singer. He did the voiceover for the narration of 500 Days of Summer. He was also a voice actor in Shrek, very small part. And he also was a bit part in Gilmore Girls and Days of Our Lives. And so we remember these here fondly for their contributions, with a moment of silence here in their honor. Thank you. All right, we get to what everyone has been waiting for this evening, the Stanley Rubric tiebreaker. I wish I had like a trumpet section sound effect or something for that, but oh well. We move on. For our tiebreaker, and we've only done this one time before, when we decided our tiebreaker between three of your favorite films of all time, Apollo 13, Blazing Saddles, and Young Frankenstein, we took each category and ranked them 1, 2, 3 in order to determine the tiebreaker method. So we will apply that again, even though we have only two films this time. We will pick which one we think has the better legacy, impact, and significance, novelty, classicness, and rewatchability. And we already have our figured out audience score for this one, and then figure out which of the two, by adding up all the categories that each film wins, which one breaks the tie. And if we go to a sudden death, I'm not sure what we're going to do. We'll have to figure it out at that point. So I hope one wins four categories.
Okay.
Maybe if we get at like an impasse on one category, we'll just say it's a halved or it's tied and we move on to the next category. But I don't know.
All right.
So Legacy is up first. Our original rankings on these ones, and you can find our original episodes both in season one, the first of which I believe was American Graffiti was number 28th, originally released on August 18th, 2020. And Goldfinger was our 46th episode on November 18th, 2020. And if you don't want to go digging around whichever podcast player you have, just visit the link in the episode descriptions. You can go right to our website. And I already did all the work for you. There are individual podcast players embedded in the webpage that accompanies this particular episode that has all three episodes right there. So you can just play them right from the webpage. It'll be very easy. But our original rankings on this one, Goldfinger originally had a 9.5 legacy, and American Graffiti had a 9. In essence, we originally thought Goldfinger was the higher legacy film. Do you still feel that way?
No, I don't. Because we, again, are a quiz my staff on Monday, and I was amazed at the people under 40 who have never really even seen it. And so I don't think it has nearly the impact that I thought it did, other than in with regard to the Bond franchise. Whereas I think American Graffiti has a more vast impact on a whole genre of films. I don't think Goldfinger has as much impact, other than the shows I mentioned and a couple of movie franchises. I don't think it has nearly the impact overall that American Graffiti had.
I'll take it from a multifaceted front. I agree with you, but I'll add some reasons on top of it. One, I don't think that you can credit Goldfinger specifically for the burgeoning spy genre of the 60s. It's more of an effect of the movies as a whole, because Dr. No is 1962, then From Russia with Love is 63, then Goldfinger in 64, then you have Thunderball in 65. All of those being right back to back to back and all being highly grossing movies, I think aids to America's fascination and thirst for spy thrillers or spy genre stuff. The books were very popular at that time. Jean Le Carré, Robert Ludlum, all of these authors started to really become popular in spy novels post-World War II. And I think your description earlier that it was speaking towards a World War II greatest generation situation, those were the people that were really sucking these up. Now, as far as American Graffiti, you mentioned that it kind of resets, or I don't know if it creates, but allows to manifest a lot of the teenage angst films, a lot of teen comedies that come after this. And I think every generation kind of resets itself with its own version of this type of movie that I mentioned, several of which came up in the early portion of this show. I will also say that, especially given that you had it as, I think, your number two film last week, and our guest list, Mr. Andrew Corns, or Acorns, Corn Dog, any of those names are appropriate, he had it as his number one film. American Graffiti's success and the amount of money it ended up grossing for George Lucas got Star Wars off the ground. So even if you want to credit it not only with creating a genre of film to itself, but also creating one of the greatest franchises of all time and spurring forward one of Hollywood's greatest directors, if not for anything other than his vast wealth from creating possibly the biggest original franchise of its own in Star Wars, I think it easily eclipses Goldfinger, which can be a little bit lost within the greater franchise and even within Connery films to some people, not necessarily me, but to some. I think it has the superior legacy. So I have American Graffiti 1, I have Goldfinger 2. So we agreed on that one. All right. Impact and significance. Now, again, this is within the 5 years after it originally came out. Our original rankings, we had Goldfinger at 9, and we had American Graffiti at 8.5. Do you think that is correct?
I thought about this a long time, and I still believe that Goldfinger in the immediate had the greater impact. There were references, there were quotes, there were stories. There was a whole string of episodes of the Beverly Hillbillies where Jethro thinks he's going to be a double knot spy and goes through the whole thing and puts metal in his hat and all this stuff. I think it had the greater impact within the very short period in society in general and in pop culture.
Thinking back on how I gave several of my legacy scores, again, I would point to that I don't think it's Goldfinger individually that would be responsible for all of these things, but James Bond as a whole. So how much weight can you add to this one movie in a greater collection of things? That would be part of my reason of pushback against what I think is a valid point of the burgeoning spy genre of the time. I think you could also say, again, that American Graffiti, while it does create a genre, the teenage angst films didn't really burgeon until, I would say, probably the early 80s, and more specifically into the mid-80s. While there were some teenage angst comedies, high school comedies, they just didn't quite hit the peak that they did about 10 years after this came out.
Yeah. It's in part when things got a little more lax with the R and PG ratings. So they could get away with a little more.
I guess where I would differentiate is both of these movies had similar box office success. If you adjust for inflation, their numbers are almost exactly the same. They both finished at number 3 in their individual year at the box office. But American Graffiti had the better awards attention, I think would be the higher rated film among the industry and to a degree, maybe even a wider audience than James Bond, which seems a little bit more narrow in its overall impact and the audience that it was necessarily targeting. And I'll hang my hat on this one where I would have it pushed over the edge. I have Graffiti being partially responsible for giving us Star Wars 4 years later. So if that's going to be part of the impact, I will say that Graffiti is a higher impact score for me than Goldfinger.
Not a hill on which I wish or I want to die. So I'll agree with you.
Okay. Then let's move to novelty rankings. I don't think this is going to garner a ton of discussion, but our original rankings on this one were an 8.5 for Graffiti and a 7.5 for Goldfinger. What say you?
I definitely think that Graffiti is the more novel of the two films.
I don't think it's really even that close. It's an original story. It kind of redefines, if not creates, a genre by itself. Goldfinger is based on a book in another series of novels. It's the third film in 3 years with kind of the same host of characters, roughly, following a very simple format. The one place where I would say that Goldfinger, if we are applying our more modern take on what novelty is comparative to what we did probably in season one, it is a highly stylized execution of this format, whereas Dr. No doesn't have as many of the gadgets and the sidekick henchman type and several of the other branding effects that you get from later Bond films that they become known for that primarily are happening in Goldfinger and then become popular as a result of the popularity of that particular film. I still don't think it jumps over what Graffiti was as far as originality and in its execution to be the more novel film. So I have Graffiti number one. I have Goldfinger two in this category.
Same.
All right. So let's take our second commercial break and we will be right back. Before we jump back into the episode, and before we get to the Stanley rubric in a minute, if you're ever curious about our Master Greatest Movies of All Time list that has every graded movie we've ever discussed on the show, there's a link in the episode description of every episode of this show, or you can go to ronnieduncanstudios.com/gmodepodcast and find it as the top entry on the Greatest Movie of All Time podcast show page. That has the grades we've done so far for all 191 movies we've graded, and we continue to add more each week. Make sure to check that out as we go and follow along. Also, you can follow each individual episode on our website as well, including this one, that has the notes for each individual episode with all of our scores, category nominations, and the individual factoids for each episode of the show. Just click the link in the episode description of this episode or go to ronnieduncanstudios.com/gmotepodcast to find that. All right, Dad, we left off at classicness. Our original rankings on this one was 9 for American Graffiti and a 5.75 for Goldfinger.
We do not need to even debate this one.
Why? Goldfinger's not classic for you?
Well, smacking the girl on the ass?
That's the least of things, because I've always had an issue in this particular movie, and I would guess this is why the score was driven so low, but essentially Bond forcing himself on pussy galore.
Yeah.
Or happening upon Jill Masterson and then like wooing her in such a way that there's a lot of the male wish fulfillment in this movie that makes it ill classic. Whereas American Graffiti, while it's somewhat male dominated, it's kind of got an older aesthetic and certainly value set. It hasn't aged as poorly because it's made with a certain level of looking back honesty on it comparatively. And so I think because the aims of the films are two very different things, they have a much different timelessness about them. So yes, I have American Graffiti 1, Goldfinger 2. So far, this is a clean sweep for American Graffiti.
Yeah.
All right, rewatchability. Our original rankings on this one were a 9.25 for Goldfinger, and for American Graffiti, a 6.5. What say you?
I don't know. Goldfinger to me is comfort food. I would give it higher marks than American Graffiti. I like American Graffiti, but I can put Goldfinger on and I'm good.
I agree with you. Goldfinger is easily the more rewatchable film for me. I can see how other people might like American Graffiti a little bit more because they have a certain level of nostalgia. But Goldfinger holds a more permanent place in my individual heart, just for it was something I grew up with. It's something I have a lot of memories with. I just also think that it does not really slow down. It has propulsive action, at least for those that enjoy the Bond films, pretty much throughout. It's a shorter film, not by a lot, but at least enough. And it doesn't really seem to drag, whereas there are big sections of American Graffiti where it just gets so slow. When they're going to like the makeout hill, that 20 to 30 minute stretch just seems to drag so long for me. So there's a good section in the middle of this that I thought could have been maybe cut up a little bit better. And I know that's criticizing a film that I have a high respect for. Obviously, I put it in my top 15 of 1970s films last week, but I find Goldfinger eminently more rewatchable than American Graffiti.
Quite frankly, a lot of the longer dialogue scenes between Ron Howard and Sidney Williams, you could fast forward through them and it wouldn't make any difference what the film was about. I just find them rather lame.
Cliche, tiresome.
Benign, overdone, excessively long.
It feels like puppy love, yeah.
Yeah.
The overall weight of that particular relationship and that storyline is much less significant to me than Milner or Toad or Dreyfus's character. That one seems to take much more of a background and be between two people that are fairly immature, comparatively. All right, so we finally got Goldfinger on the board. Unfortunately, it's 4-1, but with our audience score rankings, the original rankings when we only in season one were doing Rotten Tomatoes, we had an 8.9 for Goldfinger and we had an 8.4 for American Graffiti. Now, our readjusted rankings, inputting now Google scores with these, we had an 88% for Google on Goldfinger and an 89% on Rotten Tomatoes. So the Rotten Tomatoes score did not change, but our overall ranking would now be an 8.85. And for American Graffiti, it originally was an 84. It stays an 84 on Rotten Tomatoes, but is now added to with a 78% from Google users, giving us an 8.1. So Goldfinger wins out on this category as well. Meaning that when you capitulated on impact and significance in category two, that put American Graffiti ahead 4-2. Now, did you want to take a second and maybe argue that, or do you feel this is the rightful winner?
It's the rightful winner. It is, in the retrospect, the better film.
So to recap all of the categories here, we had American Graffiti winning for legacy, impact and significance, novelty, classicness, and Goldfinger winning for rewatchability and audience score, giving us the tiebreaker of American Graffiti slightly ahead of Goldfinger in the official rankings. So that will be our current 53rd film. Goldfinger will be 54. If you disagree with us on any of our categories, you can certainly write to us at greatestalltimemoviepodcast@gmail.com. If you have any disagreement just generally with who we are, what we are, or the show in general, you can find us on any of our socials at YouTube, Instagram, X, Letterboxd, or TikTok at the handle at Gmode Podcast. So that takes us to everyone's favorite section, Ask Dana Anything. And this would be where I would play a game show music if I had some. Anyway. All right, let's see. What's the least obnoxious one to start with? Yeah, this one looks good. If Dana could have dinner with any three actors or directors, living or dead, who would he choose and why?
Robert Downey Jr., James Stewart, and Cary Grant.
So you picked all actors, and I should mention this, said actors or directors. Does that change the math at all?
No, I'll take that back. I would, boy, I love Cary Grant, and I would love to spend time just talking to him. But I would rather, I think I would substitute Hitchcock than for Cary Grant.
All right, so you have Downey, you have Jimmy Stewart, and you have Alfred Hitchcock.
Yes.
Okay, now why?
Every once in a while, you'll read a piece or talk to somebody, and you get a feel that you have a similar set of personality traits or things of similar like. And I've always had that feeling every time I've seen an interview or watched Downey. I just have this feeling that there would be a connection between us, even though our lives have been vastly different.
You don't mean you were a damaged child actor?
Yeah. But I think there would be a connection. James Stewart, simply because his life is so fascinating. His what's really a dual part of his career before the war and after the war, his service in the war, his military service, and the fact of just he was such a nice guy type of thing. I just would be fascinated. I would love to just spend time talking to him and listening to his stories. And for Hitchcock, his concept of the creative process and how he envisioned each film, each shot, each scene, both visually and script-wise, and was able to capture those visions in film. I would love to just talk to him about that process.
Now, for the more obnoxious question.
Okay, I'm ready.
When you're at the movie theater and you're sitting next to a stranger who is talking throughout the movie, are you the type to give them the death stare? Or do you speak up and tell them to be quiet? Or do you angrily internalize it?
I guess the first question is how bad is the talking? I mean, is it audible that you can't help but hear everything that's being said?
I've given you all the parameters I can give you for the question as it was asked. I can't get inside this person's head.
all I can tell you is that if it became to the point where it's distracting, I would probably be the one that would say, would you please be quiet? And if they wouldn't, I'd go get an usher.
Yeah, that seems about on par. I think that makes sense, knowing you. All right, you've gone through the list again. You know what? I'll throw in the third one just because I probably should have used it for this particular episode, but what's your Bond actor rankings top to bottom?
Connery, Craig.
Now, is that 1-2 or is that 1A, 1B?
1-2.
Okay.
3 is going to be Roger Moore. 4 would be George Lazenby. 4 would be Pierce Brosnan. 5 would be Timothy Dalton.
Yeah, 1A, 1B, Connery, Craig, it makes the most sense. I have Lazenby 3. After that, it's kind of a crapshoot. Like, I could have the other three in just about any order. I'll take Brosnan 4. I'll put Moore 5. And I'll put Dalton 6. But I think you could switch those in any order, and I really wouldn't have a problem. Final thoughts for the week.
You and I were at part of the Wisconsin Film Festival in Madison, Wisconsin. I enjoyed it a lot. I hope you did too. The first film we saw was an independent film called Feeling That the Time for Doing Something Has Passed. It was an interesting concept, interesting film. I thought it was funny. The humor was more deadpan and ironically based. The director was there and referred to it as a
BDSM comedy.
Yeah, and I wasn't sure what I was going to get, and,
That was a fairly honest comment.
Yeah, I tried to, I thought about that, and I'm like, well, okay, I'll try it, see how it goes. I enjoyed it. We also did see a documentary called Film is Dead, Long Live Film, which was about film collectors. People who, as a hobby, would look for lost or pieces of film or old movies and collect them and put them in their collection and show them. And some of these people have been instrumental in finding lost films because the studios did not protect or preserve their film libraries because they didn't see any need to. So these people have had a real significant impact on films, especially the silent era and the early talking films, and I really enjoyed that documentary. That was followed by a print from an early version of Jerry Lewis's The Disorderly Orderly that I understood was from Lewis's originally from his private vault. The person that was his archivist was there with the film.
So I think that's factually incorrect. So it was one of the film collector's personal library as opposed to Jerry Lewis's private library.
Well, it was one of the early versions, pre-cut. It was beautiful. The colors and the lighting and everything was beautiful. It was well done. It was on the original 35 millimeter stock. It looked really good. And it had been a film that I don't think I had ever seen before, although I'd seen a lot of those Jerry Lewis films when I was a kid, and I enjoyed it. And then lastly, we went on Sunday, and we saw two silent films from 1928 that were directed by Frank Capra, and they had a live piano player doing the music overlay, and that live piano really brought those silent films to life and made them into something very enjoyable. And I was shocked by how well I enjoyed them and how well they kind of actually held up as far as the stories in them and how they were shot and what was going on. I think you could do a more modern version with language or talking, and it would at least have some interest from the masses.
For someone who has self-professed to having a lot of difficulty with silent films, I will say that the live music overlay did really enhance the film, or the film viewing, at least for me. And I was very appreciative. I mean, the guy was basically playing for 2 hours straight. And other than when it took time to load one film reel and then take it off and put on the next one, so we got to stretch for about 3 minutes, the guy was playing for 2 hours plus straight. So, I mean, the stamina to be able to do that is kind of fascinating. Not only that, but as I watched him playing and watching the movie, because he wanted to make sure that the musical cues were right on, I mean, that's a level of commitment and dexterity that I don't know if I've seen too many other people be able to accomplish other than live performers. And I have to give him a lot of credit. He was obviously the best performer of that day. But I will say, for, again, not being a huge silent film fan, I enjoyed both of the movies a lot more than I thought I might have. Had they gone on much longer than about the hour and 10 minute mark from where they were intended, in the way that certain like D.W. Griffith films do, I would have probably lost a lot of interest. But, you know, about that hour 65, 70 minute mark, I had no real issues with what was going on. Was able to follow things pretty clearly. And I thought they had a lot of character and heart for as old as they were. They very much reminded me of the, even though one had a tragic ending, the sentimentalist Capra that we've come to know and love and that we recently discussed on our It Happened One Night episode.
Yes. I mean, you can see the foundations of his filmmaking and his style in these films.
Any other thoughts for the week?
I'm looking forward to the Beloit Film Festival coming up, and I'll be spending a couple of 3 days on there for that. Have it kind of all mapped out and which films to go and see, and have a wide variety of things.
I am going to a live free showing of The Holdovers with a Q&A following by Alexander Payne on Friday. And I know that it will have happened by the time that this episode comes out, but I should have some additional notes for that as well. Additionally, there are a couple of movies that are now coming out that I very much would like to see. I know that we have Monkey Man that just came out this last week, and I haven't been able to get to see it yet. I'm very much interested in Dev Patel's directorial debut and his kind of East meets West action style, as I know it got a lot of good buzz at South by Southwest. I'm also very much looking forward to, in a couple of weeks, The Fall Guy with Ryan Gosling kind of making his next big movie foray after his I'm Just Ken Bring Down the House number at the Oscars. So definitely a lot to look forward to. Next week, we're having on two different guests that have been here before. We have Walter Gaynor and Rob Conlon coming back onto the show. And they both have previously seen Man on Fire. They both very much enjoy it. And you and I have not.
That is true.
It will be Two Fanatics Leading the Blind. It is currently available on Max as of right now.
All right.
That looks like a good stopping point for the week. That'll do it for us. Thank you for listening. In the church, they say to forgive. Forgiveness is between them and God. It's my job to arrange the meeting. Next week, for our 208th episode, we discuss a modern action classic with Man on Fire, celebrating its 20th anniversary, directed by Tony Scott, written by Brian Helgeland, music by Harry Gregson-Williams, starring Denzel Washington, Dakota Fanning, Christopher Walken, and Giancarlo Giannini. You won't want to miss that one, so watch ahead of the show by searching the Real Good app to find where it's streaming for you. That's R-E-E-L-G-O-O-D. Please like, follow, rate, and review, or whatever on whichever platform you have so that more can join in our fun. You can also email the show at thenewRonnieDuncanStudios.com or at greatestalltimemoviepodcast@gmail.com or find us on YouTube, Instagram, X, Letterboxd, or TikTok at the handle at Gmode Podcast. The Greatest Movie of All Time is a production of Ronnie Duncan Studios. Our show is mixed, edited, and written by Thomas Duncan. Our music is thanks to Purple Planet Music. Our technical provider and distributor is Captivate FM.